This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The Defense Department chief says an Army officer has no reason to fear retribution for testifying before Congress in the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
During a trip to New York, Defense Secretary Mark Esper was asked about potential retribution against Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. Esper responded, the Pentagon has protections for whistleblowers and says Vindman or anyone else who comes forward shouldn't have any fear of retaliation. Vindman is a Ukraine specialist at the White House who testified about concerns President Trump was delaying military aid to Ukraine while pressing that country to investigate political rivals. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Washington, D.C. and the rest of the region are bracing for wintry weather weeks ahead of the official start of the season. VOA's Lattice Hook with details.
In addition to snow, many East Coast states have been hit by unusually cold weather. A so-called Arctic blast swept from the north last week, bringing freezing temperatures across two-thirds of the eastern states. Another one is expected to hit this week, bringing record-breaking low temperatures to many eastern states, extending as far south as the states of Florida and Texas by Wednesday. Larissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The United States government is applauding the resignation of Bolivian President Evo Morales and rejecting assertions by several countries, including Mexico, that he was forced out by a coup. U.S. President Trump, in a statement, called Morales' departure a significant moment for democracy in the Western Hemisphere. After nearly 14 years and his recent attempt to override the Bolivian constitution and the will of the people, Morales' departure preserves democracy and paves the way for Bolivian people to have their voices heard. This is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits Washington, D.C. this week to meet with President Trump. It's a meeting some consider an opportunity to reset relations that have been strained over numerous policy differences. Turkey's military operation against the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG, is expected to top the agenda. Ankara designates the YPG as terrorist, but the militia is a crucial ally in the U.S.-led war against Islamic State. Meanwhile, as Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reports, we're seeing more action from Erdogan before the planned meeting.
Turkey's President Tayyip Erdogan is following through on a promise to start deporting captured Islamic State fighters back to their home countries, mostly in Europe and the United States. Turkish media is reporting that an American jihadist and a German have been expelled and will follow with more. Turkey eventually plans to get rid of about 2,500 militants. Many were previously held by Kurdish forces before the Turkish offensive forced the Kurds out. It's not yet clear where the prisoners are being transported or how the Western countries are reacting. Several have previously refused to take back the militants and have even revoked their citizenship.
That is Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reporting. In a highly unusual move, the tiny West African nation of the Gambia on Monday filed a lawsuit against Myanmar, accusing it of perpetrating a genocide of ethnic Rohingya Muslims, which forced hundreds of thousands to flee the Asian nation. VOA's Margaret Bashir.
Starting in August 2017, more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims quickly fled a scorched earth campaign unleashed by the Myanmar military in response to attacks by Muslim militants inside Myanmar that killed a dozen police officers. Survivors crossed the border into Bangladesh, where they gave harrowing accounts of massacres, rape, murder, and villages burned to the ground. They continued to live there in a massive refugee camp, too afraid to return to their villages in Myanmar. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Uranium particles have been detected in an undeclared nuclear site in Iran, the United Nations nuclear watchdog said on Monday. In a confidential report obtained by news agencies, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed the man-made uranium particles had been discovered without revealing the location of the undeclared site. The report also confirmed that Iran is enriching uranium at its underground Fordo facility, a site where under the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, it had agreed not to carry out any enrichment or enrichment-related research. The U.S. pulled out of the nuclear agreement last year. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe introduces new lower denomination money to ease cash shortage.
I can confirm that the bank started collecting the funds today, and the funds are being withdrawn. It's starting the $2 coin, the $2 bank notes, and the $5 bond money.
John Maguja is governor of Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank. Lesotho's prime minister is in Kenya to improve economic cooperation. King Mswati III orders a fleet of BMWs and Rolls Royces amid poverty and unemployment. Ugandan police confirmed the arrest of 120 LGBT people. And Uganda's opposition seeks 2 million signatures to petition the ICC about human rights abuses in Uganda.
We believe the domestic criminal justice cannot address the plight of the Ugandans, and it's only international tribunals like the ICC, which probably can come to our rescue.
Idrias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Kampala City. Gambia sues Myanmar for genocide against Rohingya Muslims. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabweans are hoping to see more liquid cash in circulation following the release Monday of new banknotes by the country's Reserve Bank. The much-awaited local currency in denominations of $2 notes and coins and a $5 note hit most of the country's commercial banks on Monday, with the public expected to start accessing the notes immediately, while hopeful that the newly released notes will ease the country's current cash crunch. Reserve Bank Governor John Maguja says it will only work if shop owners and businesses deposit their money into the commercial banks rather than keeping their money in the private homes.
I can confirm that the bank started collecting the funds today, and I noticed that outside there are still some queues of CIT vehicles collecting funds from the withdrawals by banks. And those banks that collected in the morning, by now they should have their money, their cash deposits, and distributing through their bank network. What you might want to know is that money withdrawn from the Reserve Bank by banks goes through the cash deposits of banks. From their deposits, then goes through my bank networks. So, yes, things are moving okay, and the funds are being withdrawn. They're starting the $2 coin, the $2 bank note, and the $5 bond note.
How much is the first injection? We understand you are going to inject about $1 billion in 6 months' time.
Yes, we have said, and true to our promise, we are disbursing these funds, and we are allowing banks to withdraw from their accounts, maintained at the Reserve Bank over a period of 6 months. We need to continue to monitor the demand for cash within the economy, and we do believe that that target of 10% of money supply, which is short, would mean there's a gap of $1 billion, and that $1 billion will be disbursed over the 6 months, as we said. And if you just divide $1 billion by 6 months, that's a gradual way of doing business. And also, that most of the money obviously will be disbursed during the paydays. We have a high demand for money during the paydays or when pensioners are getting paid. We want to ensure those people, they get their money.
Do you see this move easing the cash shortages the country is experiencing?
Definitely, it goes a long way in easing the cash shortages. What our request and prayer is that once the funds have been disbursed or been withdrawn by commercial banks, the bank's customers, bank public, when they go and buy their goods from the shops, our prayer is that the shops should also bank their money so that money can circulate within the economy, as opposed to be a one-way traffic whereby money comes from the Reserve Bank, withdrawn by banks, goes to the banks, the money is withdrawn by their customers, won't come back again. And we want to ensure that in Zimbabwe, we ensure that we abide by what is required of money to circulate within the economy, as opposed to holding it and selling it.
John Maguja is the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Ugandan opposition and civil society groups want at least 2 million citizens to sign a petition for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to launch an inquiry into gross human rights violations in Uganda. Erias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala City, says the move will ensure that Ugandans are at the forefront of the need to hold President Yoweri Museveni and his security agencies accountable for human rights violations against opponents of Mr. Museveni. But supporters of the ruling National Resistance Movement say the petition is yet another attempt by the opposition to seek foreign interference in Uganda's internal affairs. Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Kampala City.
Well, it's a call which is anchored on the provisions of the Constitution, and Article 3 in particular. It clearly states that once there is a violation of the Constitution, abrogation of the same, gross violation of human rights, it's a duty of all adult Ugandans to rise to the occasion and take action, and they commit no offense. And whoever violates the Constitution commits treason. So right now, as we talk, the situation is dire, and the country is on the brink of becoming a failed state because of these gross violations and the transgressions. And we believe the domestic criminal justice system cannot address the plight of the Ugandans, cannot address this crisis. And it's only the international tribunals like the ICC, which probably may come to our rescue. And this is the mission we are pursuing now.
Now, so how many Ugandans do you seek to sign the petition, and when do you possibly think you can present the petition possibly to the ICC to launch an investigation into what you described as gross human rights violations and the trampling of the Constitution?
Well, we set our target a minimum of 2 million Ugandans. We thought that would be substantive enough because we want to have something that brings out the graft of the matter. And want to reach out to the victims of these heinous crimes. There are people who have been tortured in safe houses, subject of inhuman and degrading treatment by government. So our target is that we want to reach out to all the victims to get to record their testimonies, in addition to the evidence we have already gathered, because we have quite a number of reports from different agencies and also testimonies from some of these victims, and also people from within the security circles who have volunteered the information to us. But we need to reach out to the citizens of Uganda, the victims, and those who wish Uganda well, so that it is a people-centered petition. That's what we... Because time and again, when you take an initiative like this, it's watered down as if it's for a handful of politicians. So we want it to be a people-centered petition, because that's exactly what it is.
Will this petition meet the threshold of the requirement of the ICC in order for it to launch a formal inquiry without the backing of the government into what you are describing?
Yeah, we know under the Rome Statute, there are three ways of presenting a petition to the ICC. One is through the Security Council or the partner state making reference to the prosecutor. But of course, also there is that option of going straight to the prosecutor and furnish the office with the necessary information. We believe what we have gathered so far can pass that threshold, can establish what we call a prima facie case that would warrant investigation into the matter and take action against the perpetrators of these gross violations. So we have gathered quite a lot of cogent and compelling evidence, which we believe the prosecutor will have to take seriously.
Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Uganda's capital, Kampala. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 12th. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Ugandan police say they arrested 120 people around Kampala City on Monday, suspected of using narcotics. However, members of the LGBT community say police interrupted a health meeting. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Patrick Onyango, the Kampala Metropolitan Police spokesperson, tells VOA they received intelligence information that the site of the raid, the Ram Bar, is used as a massage parlor during day and for smoking opium and shisha during the night. Both products are outlawed in the Tobacco Control Act 2015, and people found guilty of using them are liable for a fine of $130 or imprisonment for a term not exceeding 6 months. Spokesman Onyango.
So we arrested 120. We are charging them under the Tobacco Control Act. We have started the process of screening and recording statement from them. They are those who shall give police bonds, students, and those who claim that they are innocent. They were just there for a dance and they were not participating in the smoking.
At the Central Police Station in Kampala, friends and members of the local LGBT community move around seemingly worried. Among them is Sean Mugisha, a paralegal who is trying to secure bail for the arrested members. Mugisha tells VOA that Ramba is the only safe place that the LGBT community has in Kampala.
But most importantly, it is a center for most outreaches. All these guys who give healthcare services, when they want to do outreaches in the community, it's one of those venues that they have been accessing. So last night there was an arrest, so I consistently got calls.
Frank Mugisha, the executive director, Sexual Minorities Uganda, says the arrests Monday are based on trumped up charges by the police.
We don't know what will happen next. I think we are still looking at the worst. Yeah, I think it's sort of aimed at intimidation of the LGBT community. The police is coming up with trumped up charges. I don't think all 120 are publicly smoking. So we're waiting for court tomorrow and see what happens.
This is the second time in less than a month that Ugandan police have raided a place frequented by members of the LGBT community. Last month, 16 members of the LGBT community were arrested but later released on police bond. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane Monday signed three key agreements to enhance cooperation between the two nations. The Lesotho Prime Minister is on a three-day visit to Kenya, which began on Sunday. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The two states have signed a deal on establishment of joint commission cooperation, a memorandum of understanding for bilateral consultation, and another memorandum in the field of sports. During the meeting with his Lesotho counterpart, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that the agreement will enable the two countries to identify and explore areas of cooperation.
We'll ensure that we enhance our political, diplomatic, and trade relations through regular and structured engagements, as well as strategic cooperation. So I therefore urge our respective teams who are here with us today to ensure that the negotiations are completed and that the framework is put in place to carry this forward.
Kenya is on the verge of reviving its textile industry, which has the potential to create high-value jobs to help address the challenge of unemployment that is facing the youth. Mr. Kenyatta said that Kenya is keen to learn about developing the textile sector from Lesotho as the country implements its Big Four agenda, especially the manufacturing pillar and addressing youth unemployment.
Deal with the challenge of unemployment that is facing our youth. Prime Minister, the Kingdom of Lesotho continues to be one of Kenya's strongest allies on the global stage. Indeed, your endorsement of Kenya as the African Union's candidate for the non-permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council for 2021-22 is an affirmation of the strong bilateral relations that exist between our two sister countries. I'm glad that today our two countries are starting a new chapter of bilateral cooperation.
On the other hand, Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane said that he is looking forward to enhanced ties between the East African nations and the Kingdom of Lesotho.
And that time has come and it has happened. I am here before you and those people who are managing the affairs of this wonderful republic, assisting you. And God bless this ceremony, because it's not going to be the first between our two countries. Let's have many more signs of very close and very genuine cooperation between our two countries.
Thabane is on a three-day visit to Kenya, as he will be expected to visit the United Nations complex in Nairobi, among other engagements. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, an official of the Pudemo political movement has reiterated the need for the kingdom to become democratized. Pudemo Secretary General Mwandile Jluglu says if Eswatini was a democracy, the people would be able to hold King Mswati III accountable about how he runs the country, particularly how the king uses the people's resources. The comments come after it was reported over the weekend that King Mswati III had ordered and received a fleet of 15 latest model BMWs and 19 Rolls Royces for his family. King Mswati III is the absolute ruler who currently has about 15 wives and 23 children. Jluglu says it is wrong for the king to use state resources for his family in the midst of poverty, unemployment, and health crisis.
It is very much true. They have been procured, paid, and delivered in the palace.
I was looking to see whether the government or the king himself or his spokesperson has confirmed that, but I haven't seen that. But you are certain they have been delivered?
Yes, they are delivered. Definitely, it is not possible for you or me to get to know or see, because in Swaziland, anything that relates to the monarchy is secrecy and is not accountable to the people.
Mwandile, what's wrong with the king ordering vehicles for himself? Because he's the king and he can say, well, these vehicles may be used for guests, dignitaries who might come to Eswatini.
There is everything wrong about the recent purchase of a fleet to the tune of almost 400 million, because the king uses state resources to entertain himself and his wives and children at the expense of an extremely impoverished country in Africa called Swaziland today, with a lot of demands, workers, unemployed, HIV, health crisis. It is one of the most bewildering and extremely confusing, if not disappointing, gesture to see that in the midst of poverty, the king only is preoccupied with what type of a new Mercedes or Rolls Royce or X5 to buy.
Mwandile, under this arrangement, who checks on the powers of the king?
Legally, procedurally, culturally, and otherwise, in the arrangement of today, it is not possible to hold the king to account. It is exactly for that reason why, as progressives for years, we have been saying this country needs to democratize so that you will be able to put checks and balances and put systems to be able to make government to be held accountable, including the institution of the monarchy. But clearly, it has been falling on deaf ears for decades now.
Is it true that recently that public sector workers have been complaining about their salaries?
Yeah, the public sector unions for the past 2 months or 3 months have been on the streets on several occasions calling for a cost of living adjustment, which is a lousy 6.5% demand. And His Majesty's government has been pleading poverty consistently and responding with vicious attacks on peaceful unarmed protesters.
So as it stands, therefore, I can say nothing can be done.
Definitely, there is that to be done. Progressive formations yesterday had met and are still going to meet to finalize the way forward around what form of mass action they can engage in. But also, we're calling upon the government of the United States, who are some of the biggest supporters, financially and politically and otherwise, of His Majesty's government, to really consider their stance, their soft stance on His Majesty's government, as well as these resources that they keep pumping into a government that is said to be poor, when the reality actually points to the contrary. Some form of smart targeted sanctions on the leadership of Mswati and the royal family and government may be one of the most necessary steps to be taken by the international community. And America must take the lead, because they are one of the leaders and backers of the current regime in Swaziland.
Mwandile Jluglu is the Secretary General of the People's United Democratic Movement, also known as PUDEMO. He was speaking with us from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. The small West African nation of the Gambia filed a lawsuit on Monday against Myanmar at the International Court of Justice, accusing Myanmar of perpetrating a genocide on ethnic Rohingya Muslims, which it says has forced hundreds of thousands to flee the Asian nation. As VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports, the move by Gambia is a highly unusual one for two countries not at war with each other.
Starting in August 2017, more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims quickly fled a scorched earth campaign unleashed by the Myanmar military in response to attacks by Muslim militants inside Myanmar that killed a dozen police officers. Survivors crossed the border into Bangladesh, where they gave harrowing accounts of massacres, rape, murder, and villages burned to the ground. They continued to live there in a massive refugee camp, too afraid to return to their villages in Myanmar. The Gambia is supported by the 57-member Organization for Islamic Cooperation in its complaint. Paul Riker, a Washington, D.C.-based attorney who heads the Gambian legal team, spoke to VOA about the case.
The Gambia hopes by this case, and the OIC hopes by this case, to obtain a judgment from the International Court of Justice, the highest legal authority in the international community, that Myanmar is guilty of the crime of genocide against the Rohingya people.
Such a ruling could take years. In the meantime, the lawyers are seeking an order demanding Myanmar stop harming the Rohingyas. That decision could come as early as December.
So we're hopeful to get that kind of protection for the Rohingya people very early in the case as a provisional measure so that the genocidal activities that we're seeking to end don't continue during the lawsuit.
The Myanmar government strongly disputes accusations of genocide. UN Ambassador Haudo Swan told VOA in an email that the lawsuit is a politically motivated international pressure tactic against his government and that the Gambia should mind its own business. Richard Dicker, director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, says the Gambia is within its rights to file the complaint.
Gambia has filed, in a very innovative and creative way, a complaint against the government of Myanmar that Myanmar violated its obligations as a state under the terms of the Genocide Convention. Both the Gambia and Myanmar are state members of that convention to prevent and punish genocide.
The UN has called the atrocities a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, and the head of a UN fact-finding mission said last year that estimates of 10,000 Rohingya deaths are conservative. The only other successful prosecution of a genocide case under the Genocide Convention at the ICJ was brought by Bosnia and Herzegovina against Serbia in 1993. It took 4 years for the court to issue its decision, largely in favor of Bosnia. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, Zimbabweans are hoping to see more liquid cash in circulation following the release Monday of new banknotes by the country's Reserve Bank. The much-awaited local currency in denominations of $2 notes and coins and a $5 note hit most of the country's commercial banks on Monday, with the public expected to start accessing the notes immediately, while hopeful that the newly released notes will ease the country's current cash crunch. Reserve Bank Governor John Manguya says it will only work if shop owners and businesses deposit their money into the commercial banks rather than keep their money in their homes. Ugandan opposition and civil society groups want at least 2 million citizens to sign a petition for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to launch an inquiry into gross human rights violations in Uganda. Erias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala City, says the move will ensure that Ugandans are at the forefront of the need to hold President Yoweri Museveni and his security agencies accountable for human rights violations against Mr. Museveni's opponents. And that is it for this Tuesday, November 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
I'm a sucker for- I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without.
The CD features Billie Eilish's Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type.
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.